I'm Matthew Petty and this is Intersection. Hearings wrapped up on Monday in the trial over congressional redistricting. To recap, the old congressional maps were thrown out by the Florida Supreme Court, which ruled they violated the state's anti-gerrymandering rules. A special session in August ended without agreement after the Florida House and Senate couldn't agree on new maps. Then the dispute was sent back to Leon County Judge Terry Lewis to decide. The judge now has 7 maps to choose from, and whatever he decides will have an impact on lawmakers in Central Florida, including Republican Congressman Daniel Webster. The case has so far cost the taxpayers of Florida more than $8 million. Judge Lewis has a deadline of October 17th to decide, but he says he wants to get it done by the end of next week. Is this the end of the redistricting saga? What will those redrawn maps mean for the voters? And what happens next? Taking your calls 1-866-338-5252. That's 1-866-338-5252. And joining me in the studio, Beth Kassab from the Orlando Sentinel. Welcome back, Beth.
Thanks for having me.
And we have Frank Torres from the Orlando Political Observer. Welcome back, Frank.
Great to be here.
And joining us from WFSU in Tallahassee, reporter Nick Evans. Nick Evans, welcome to Intersection.
Good morning. Great to talk to you.
And you too. And also on the line from Daytona, we're going to bring him in later, actually. But anyway, Nick, let's start with you. You were in court for this latest hearing. Just remind us of who the different parties were in this case.
Well, you've got the House and the Senate, and they are not necessarily on the same side. You've got the League of Women Voters and Common Cause. These are two voting rights groups that are aligned as one set of plaintiffs. And then you also have the Romo plaintiffs, which are a group of people headed up by Renee Romo from Key West.
Mm-hmm. So what was the kind of flavor of the discussion? Obviously, there's been a lot of back and forth between the House and the Senate over redistricting. We had the League of Women Voters. They brought one of the plaintiffs in the case. They've been pretty vocal on this. What was the kind of flavor of the back and forth in the courtroom?
Well, the central point of discussion for most of this last round of hearings was the line between districts 26 and 27. They tend to agree on almost all the rest of the map. Mm-hmm. What had happened is the line got moved because let's see here. The Supreme Court had said that. The Republican legislature had split Homestead to give a benefit to the Republican Party.
And just remind us, Nick Evans, 26 and 27, South Florida?
Ah, yes. It's Miami area. Mm-hmm. It runs right along the just to the west of Miami, near Homestead. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So
go ahead.
Keep going.
Oh, okay. The Supreme Court had said that Homestead was split to give Republicans an advantage in 26. And then under the new drawing, people like League of Women Voters and Common Cause looked and said, well, wait, you're actually giving Republicans an even greater benefit in 26 after the way that you've drawn it. So what they had asked is that the line be moved such that three heavily African-American communities that were I believe taken out of 26 would get put back in.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the districts we've been paying close attention to in Central Florida is Daniel Webster's District 10. Was there much discussion of that in this latest court hearing?
Not really. You know, he sent a lawyer at the very outset who was trying to intervene in the case, which had that been successful, it would have been very interesting. You know, you would have had for every single witness examination from the House lawyer, the mm-hmm. Senate lawyer, the League of Women Voters lawyer, and the Romo plaintiff's lawyer, and Daniel Webster's lawyer for every single witness. So the various parties to the case all agreed, and the judge did as well, that you know it's too far along now to intervene in the case. We're going to move on as we are.
Mm-hmm. And what about Corrine Brown's district? Now, what kind of changes are there likely to be in that new map?
Drastic. It used to go from Jacksonville down to New Orlando, and now instead it's kind of shifted sort of 45 degrees off to the left, and it runs from Jacksonville past Leon in Tallahassee, where I am, I think even out into Gadsden County. Mm-hmm. It's a drastic change.
Mm-hmm. She wasn't too happy about that district, as was Daniel Webster, both of them kind of speaking out against the proposed changes. Did we see Corrine Brown? Did she make an appearance during this hearing?
No, she did not. And actually, she has been rather quiet lately, even with the revelations from Politico about the prison populations that will be a part of the proposed district that runs mm-hmm. east-west.
Mm-hmm. Now, the judge is aiming for a decision on the map by the end of next week. So what happens next, Nick Evans? Is this the end of this legal battle, or could there be more challenges?
You know, probably not. Part of the reason why Corrine Brown is not currently in federal court challenging this is because there had not been any injury. You know, I think we have to take a step back. We talk about these maps as if they're already done, but you know, nothing has actually changed since the special session in the last year, and actually, even that has not actually been enacted yet. So, because of the way the Supreme Court ruled in July, once something gets approved, and because all of the parties agree, at least generally, on the east-west orientation of the map, once that gets approved and enacted, then Corrine Brown can go into federal court saying that I've been injured by what has happened with the state Supreme Court and the state legislature, and she can begin that case.
Mm-hmm.
She may decide not to, but I have my doubts.
What's your take on the redistricting saga? Is it going to change the way you vote? We want to hear from you. 1-866-338-5252. Frank Torres, let me turn to you now. Let's talk a little more about Corrine Brown. Her district is completely changed in the proposed map, as Nick Evans was pointing out. Can she win what likely will be a brand new district?
You know, I believe she could win that new district, but her confidence apparently is shaken. There's been a lot of rumors that she could jump into what is an already crowded Democratic primary in the 10th district with two other high-profile Democrats, State Senator Geraldine Thompson and former Orlando Police Chief Val Demings. You know, she really wants the African-American communities here in Central Florida, and, you know, she's willing to do whatever it takes to make that happen.
Mm-hmm. State Rep Jeanette Adkins made a comment about more inmates in the newly drawn district, as Nick Evans was referring to.
Right.
She said that would make it more winnable by a Republican candidate. And Corrine Brown picked up on that, calling it, quote, a non-performing district not only for an African-American but for a member of the Democratic Party. Does she have a point here?
You know, Representative Adkins took a lot of, you know, static for those remarks, and you've seen it in the news over a couple of days. You know, we're just gonna have to see how it all shakes out, you know, in the coming months involving these maps. But she's gonna go down swinging. She's held press conferences in Jacksonville, downtown Orlando, with her attorneys, vowing to fight this thing down to the very end.
Mm-hmm. You expecting a challenge from her?
I am expecting a challenge from her, and I believe that she's going to be the last one swinging all the way until, you know, the final judgment or decision comes down, whether it's from the Florida Supreme Court or whether it moves up higher or, you know, to another legal body.
Mm-hmm. Well, Beth Kassab, let me bring you in on this conversation. What about the amount of money spent on this case over the last years? $8 million. How will we know if that's all been worth it?
Well, that's going to be a hard question to answer. I think for many average voters, this is a lot of inside baseball. And it basically amounts to politicians, you know, arguing to save their own hides. And I think a lot of people would look at that and say, why are we spending this significant amount of money on litigation?
Mm-hmm. Well, is $8 million a fair price to get these maps right? Is this the way? What is the way forward, rather, for redistricting in the future? 1-866-338-5252. Nick Evans, I want to just come back to you for a minute. This year seems to have been pretty rocky for lawmakers, the House and Senate, not really seeing eye to eye on much. We had some issues around healthcare, congressional districts being just a couple of examples. What's your impression of it as a Tallahassee reporter, though? How is this compared to, say, you know, the previous year in the legislature?
Well, I can't look back too far. I've only been at this for a couple of years, but I can tell you that there is a stark difference between the interaction, especially between the House and the Senate now as compared to last year. Now, you look at the special session to redraw districts that happened in 2014. Republican majorities in the House and Senate walked in with basically a completed map. had maybe five or six hearings, approved it on party line votes, sent it to the floor, and approved it. Got done in 3 days. It was lightning fast. And what we've seen now is that the House and Senate, you know, they can't agree on anything. And you look at some of the people in the House taking pot shots at the Senate. It's very clear that they are not totally over the fight that happened earlier this year about health care and the budget.
Mm-hmm. Well, looking ahead then, we've got another redistricting wrangle coming up. A special session is coming up pretty close to redraw state Senate maps. What are you anticipating from that, Nick Evans? Are we going to see some agreement on those maps from the House and Senate?
Well, we'll cross our fingers, but I have doubts. You know, like I said, at the end of the special session, the most recent one for congressional districts, people were just in debate and even in second reading were just jumping up and just tearing into the Senate for settling and then agreeing to, you know, come back in a third special session this year. One of the things that's going to be different is that this is as you said, a state Senate district. So typically the chambers give one another deference in writing lines. So it could be that the House will sort of step back and let the Senate make a presentation, and you know they may be tired. Mm-hmm. They may want to get on to preparing for the coming session, and they'll just say, okay, we'll move forward with this. The other thing that's sort of a curveball is if you recall from the congressional special session, they agreed to create a base map. Now, for the Senate districts, they're going to have three different base maps. Mm-hmm. So there won't be a sense that what you see is what you get. There will be a little bit of a wiggle room that can come into play. So that could mean that the Senate approves one of them and everyone in the House says, no, you should have approved one of the other ones. But we'll cross our fingers that hopefully they can, you know, begin to play nice with one another.
Indeed. I want to take a call now. Going to the phones, we've got Robert. Robert is calling from Osceola. Robert, you're on the air.
Thank you. Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to comment and get some feedback on your discussion about the redistricting. The Florida Republican Party held meetings, apparently, and Representative Janet Atkins kind of led this discussion about the laying out of the lines that mm-hmm. would include, as you referenced, all the prison populations, which I think there's about 16 prisons across northern Florida, which would disallow any of that voting. So I'd like to hear from the people there on your show reflecting on what seems to be a conspiracy towards these, that they're really, yes, damages may be able to be taken after the election, but because of what the Supreme Court did in striking down Section 4 of the Voting Rights Act, this is after the fact. And if you can make these redistricting that are quite obviously done purposefully to change the map, heading up into key elections, that it could have a dramatic impact, not just on the outcomes, but short-term and long-term. So I'd appreciate your comments on Representative Atkins' committee actions.
Robert, thank you so much for your call. I do appreciate it. Frank, I wonder if you want to take that one. What about those prisons in that across that kind of patch of northern Florida? You know, how does that change the equation?
You know, I don't think it changes the equation that much, you know, in the whole general span of things. What you're going to have here, you're always going to have controversies with these lawmakers. You're asking them, like it was mentioned earlier, this is self-preservation. And, you know, there's going to be little dynamics or little examples with each of these districts over how the process should be done. And it really goes back to really the way the redistricting is handled in general. A lot of people think it should be handled by, you know, a third party instead of asking lawmakers to really draw the rules out for themselves. So with the Atkins situation and other conflicts, not only with these congressional districts, you're always going to have these sorts of individual examples of where the ideas or the intentions behind the way the maps are drawn can come into question.
Mm-hmm. Robert, are you anticipating Corrine Brown will be taking some legal action, though, after these maps are kind of finalized?
Well, I'm not a part of her campaign, but whether it was Corrine Brown or any representative, when there are secret meetings that the party in control can take and redistrict, and obviously the tapes that have surfaced quote her very clearly in saying, this is our opportunity to take out, I think those are words to her effect, to take out Corrine Brown and eliminate her from running. So when you are actually using the system, not in a manner that was just described by your guest, but in a manner to, okay, let's target politicians who are representatives of the state, and let's incorporate. And I don't agree that when you put in 16 or 18, I can't remember the number exactly, of non-voting residents insured, and then that can swing that vote. When that's done, that's deceitful. That's taking this one step. It's not just, well, it happens, and this is a serious offense towards voting rights of fair representation. So to answer your question, no, I have no idea what Corrine Brown would do. But regardless of what she does, it would be after the fact. And so I think the Supreme Court ruling was wrong. And I think states should be able to challenge these before the elections in an appropriate, timely fashion.
Robert, do appreciate your call. Thank you so much for dialing in. Going to go to another call now. We've got Rich. Rich is calling from New Smyrna Beach. Rich, you're on the air.
Good morning, Matthew. Great show, and I applaud WMFE for expanding it.
Mm-hmm. What's on your mind about redistricting?
The question I had was, okay, we've got 67 counties in Florida, and I believe we're allowed 27 congressional districts based on population. Why aren't these maps being drawn more along county lines? Mm-hmm. I mean, it seems like, you know, you have something like Volusia and Brevard. We have an awful lot in common. There's two counties that could be part of a single district, Volusia and Flagler, or, you know, I just don't understand this rationale of trying to draw districts along lines that stretch across multiple counties, you know, in a state that is, you know, very long and very broad in the Panhandle area. So I'd be interested in hearing, you know, what your guests have to comment on that.
Rich, thank you so much for your call. I do appreciate it. Nick Evans, wonder if you might take this one. Was there any talk of any of the proposed maps that came up suggesting that some of those kind of county lines would be the sort of basis for drawing the maps, or is that really not the way it's done?
Well, following municipal boundaries is one of the charges that lawmakers are supposed to follow when they draw lines. But you also have to keep in mind that there are one person, one vote requirements, and these districts have to be drawn to be equal in population, not like by a little bit, but by, you know, one or more, like, I'm sorry, plus or minus one person.
Sure.
You know, they have to be exactly the same. So, for instance, you know, I think the caller mentioned Volusia and Brevard County.
Mm-hmm.
I think I would struggle to assume that the two counties next to those two would have the exact same amount of population, right? So you aren't able to just go by counties, which is unfortunate. That would really simplify things. It would make the process a lot simpler. But unfortunately, you have to meet these very, very stringent population requirements. And I believe that comes down from a U.S. Supreme Court decision.
Mm-hmm.
So there isn't really any getting out of that one.
Well, I'm sure this is not the last we've heard of redistricting. We've got that Senate redistricting case coming up, as we said, and the congressional maps will be drawn. Then possibly the likes of Corrine Brown, other people who weren't too happy, may challenge those maps. So not the last word on redistricting. We've been speaking to Nick Evans. He's a reporter with WFSU in Tallahassee. He's been covering that congressional redistricting case. Nick, thank you so much for joining us.
Anytime.
And you're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. When we come back, Florida Governor Rick Scott wants more transparency for hospitals to stop what he's calling price gouging. Is the governor on the right track, or was his comment mean-spirited? 1-866-338-5252 is the number. Intersection returns in a minute.
Support for 90.7 News comes from Florida Hospital. What is it that makes life so amazing? It's each member of the community doing our part to make life better. Because here in Central Florida, we're not just citizens, we're neighbors, we're friends, we're family, we're everything that makes life amazing.
Good morning, nice to have you along. We made it to Friday. You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. We're taking your calls live. Join the conversation. You can take us with you anywhere you go throughout the day by downloading the WMFE mobile app. It's free for Apple and Android devices.
Support for 90.7 News comes from ViewPost, an online business network that offers companies the ability to create and send unlimited professional invoices to business customers from the office or in the field, allowing clients to track invoices to better anticipate cash flow. Learn more at ViewPost.com. ViewPost, see business better.
Welcome back to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. With me in the studio, Beth Kassab from the Orlando Sentinel, Frank Torres, Orlando Political Observer, and joining us by phone from Daytona Beach, Pat Rice. He's the editor of the Daytona Beach News Journal. Welcome to Intersection, Pat.
Oh, thank you.
So Governor Rick Scott wants hospitals to be more transparent about what they charge for medical procedures. The governor says he'll, quote, work with the legislature to increase transparency for Florida hospitals and empower patients to fight against hospital price gouging in the upcoming 2016 legislative session. He wants to require hospitals to publish pricing information in a, quote, usable online format. Let's hear a little from the governor.
How do we take care of the 20 million people in our state that might need health care? How do we make sure that they can make an informed decision about what their health care is going to cost so they can decide where to go, when to go?
Well, Beth Kassab, what do you make of the governor's bid here to cut down on what he calls price gouging?
Well, as I said in a column earlier this week, it is a bit rich that we have a governor who is a former executive of a hospital who for many years profited off of this very lack of transparency that he now says he wants to end. You know, that aside, I still think the governor is correct on this issue. There is really no reason why the hospitals cannot make their prices more available and accessible to average people. The hospitals would lead you to believe that this is extremely complicated and, you know, it's just so hard to do and there's all these factors and, you know, you can't just shop around for healthcare in the way you might shop around for a new car or a new refrigerator. I would argue that that's not true. They know exactly what most of these procedures entail. There are very, very there are many, many common procedures that go right about the same way every time they do them, and they know how much they're going to cost and how much time they're going to take. So, you know, there needs to be a lot more transparency.
So in his statement, Governor Scott says, quote, we must also require the same level of transparency and financial disclosure for publicly funded and government-owned hospitals in Florida that we do for private hospitals. What do you read into that comment?
You know, I think that, you know, the governor and the hospitals have been warring over Medicaid expansion. And he has taken particular aim at some of the not-for-profit hospitals here in the state of Florida. It's sort of funny. It's a bit of a misnomer that these hospitals operate on a shoestring budget because they're not-for-profits. They don't. They actually happen to have some of the best profit margins in the state. And so, yes, I think that I think he is calling them out specifically.
Pat Rice from the Daytona Beach News Journal, I want to bring you into the conversation now. Your newspaper published an editorial a couple months back talking about the failing health safety net. For too many residents of Flagler and Volusia counties, the editorial read, healthcare is a dream. They can get treatment, but, quote, it often comes in hospital emergency rooms accompanied by bills they have no hope of paying. Pat Rice, what's your take on this latest push from the governor for pricing transparency?
Well, I would agree with Beth that we're all for pricing transparency, and I don't think there's any reason that hospitals can't be more transparent about what it costs to to visit them than they are right now. I just don't think there's any good reason why they can't do that. But the real fight here is between the governor and the House and the Senate over expansion of Medicaid and Obamacare. Mm-hmm. That's really what this is about. And it's a fight that the legislature and the governor are going to have to fight again in 2016. And that's really this discussion over pricing transparency in the committee that the governor has put together is really about that fight. So where that goes, I don't think anybody has a good idea, but that's what's going to have to happen.
Frank Torres, is that the way you read this? Do you see this as kind of a Trojan horse, if you will, to kind of another way to get into that Obamacare battle?
I wouldn't call it exactly a Trojan horse, but Pat's right. This is definitely, it goes back to the conflict between the Senate, the House, and the governor regarding Medicaid expansion and the quickly drying up or the removal of the low income pool funds to cover the uninsured. It's going to be a fight we're going to have to see again, and we're going to have to see how it plays out. I don't see an easy solution to the problem anywhere on the horizon. This is going to be another fight we're going to see played out possibly for years to come, and there's going to be things that the governor does to try to, shore up the other areas to try to make it look like there is some progress being made. But it really does come down to those Medicaid expansion, the Medicaid expansion fight, and the availability or the method used to eventually cover the uninsured in the state.
And, Matt, I would say, too, that while I agree with the governor on price transparency, I don't agree on his resistance to expanding Medicaid. And the reason for that actually goes back to prices. And you rarely hear this argument being made. But the thing is, insured people who have insurance and they have negotiated rates with hospitals, they're paying for those patients that are not paying their bills. Mm-hmm. The hospitals make the most money off of insured patients. So when you don't expand Medicaid, that is an argument for the hospitals to keep those prices artificially high. Mm-hmm. And, I don't know if you would ever hear the hospitals making that argument specifically, but that is true. And it all factors into what we pay and those huge bills we end up seeing at the end of a procedure or operation.
Do hospitals, though, lose money on those patients, the uninsured? Is that the flip side of that?
So they would argue that they do lose money on some of them. They provide some charity care. They are required to do that. They're required to accept Medicaid. They do get some Medicaid reimbursements, so they're getting some money there. And of course, a big percentage of what they do is Medicare, and on Medicare, I would argue they're not losing money. Mm-hmm. Medicaid would factor in nicely to their bottom line, and I think it would help with the argument that insurance premiums, need to come down.
What do you think about hospital pricing transparency? Is it easy to figure out what you're being charged for when you go get your care? Is the governor on the right track with this? 1-866-338-5252. That's 1-866-338-5252. Pat Rice, what are your readers saying about the quality of health care and what it costs out in Volusia County and Flagler County?
Well, I think in Volusia and Flagler counties, I think generally people feel that our hospital systems here provide good quality health care, and I would agree with that. But I think the issue is that these are not high income counties, and so we just have a significant population here that does not receive enough preventive care on the front end, and perhaps has some health issues that could be avoided with better education and those sorts of things. And so too often where they receive health care is truly in the emergency room. It's when they show up there, and that's when they oftentimes when they're sicker than they should be, and the illnesses they have become more problematic. So I think we have good health care, but we also have a fairly significant low-income population. Mm-hmm. And that's really the issue at the state level with expanding the Medicaid safety net is at some point the state has to just reconcile itself with that. And right now what's really happening, I think, is that they're potentially leaving money on the table that could be going to caring for lower-income people.
Mm-hmm. Frank Torres, Governor Scott says he looks forward to working with the legislature in the upcoming session to get these reforms through. However, based on what we saw in the past session, we had that big fight over healthcare, the Medicaid expansion, which folks are talking about. You know, what kind of working relationship is the governor really likely to have with the House and Senate to get these reforms through as he says he wants to?
I also look forward to seeing the governor work with the state legislator this upcoming session. Listen, right now there's a lot of dysfunction between the state House, the state Senate, and the governor. You'll recall that there was even some speculation that the Medicaid fight caused the governor or provoked the governor to veto several projects in the Orlando area that were championed by Senate President Andy Gardner, including funding for the downtown UCF campus and the Performing Arts Center. So, you know, there's a lot of, you know, tension between the House, the Senate, and the governor over this fight. You know, they're going to have to just come together and try to find some sort of middle ground. But with no LIP funding available, it's going to be difficult for these sides to come together. And there's a lot of, you know, a lot of people feel that Medicaid expansion is the answer, but there are a lot of lawmakers that come from districts that were sent up there by a constituency that doesn't support the conditions behind ACA or Obamacare. And until these representatives can find some sort of solution to pleasing their constituency while solving this budgeting problems, you're going to continue to have this impasse.
I'm going to go to the phones now. We've got Zane. Zane is calling from Orlando. Zane, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just had a question. Really, just want to get your thoughts on something. Recently, about 6 months ago, I went through a procedure, a minor procedure, and when I was inquiring about the cost of what it would be, the doctor was pretty open and said, you know, there's two different prices. If I didn't have insurance, which I do have insurance, but if I didn't have insurance, and you were billing and you were paying just straight out cash, it was roughly around $500. But if I had insurance, they would bill the insurance company more. I think he said it was around $650 or something like that. I assume to get more money from the insurance companies. But I never heard that before, and I was pretty surprised that the doctor actually came out and told me that. I didn't know that was a practice.
So essentially a kind of a parallel billing structure, if you will.
That's very common. That's actually how the system works, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, they have, you know, right now, they have a price for uninsured people, and it's usually quite high, and oftentimes they'll give you a discount if you're willing to pay up front or pay very quickly. And then there's a negotiated rate with your insurance company. And that may be different. It might be $500 for Blue Cross and $800 for Aetna. It depends on the negotiating power of the hospital and the insurance plan.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, obviously consumers who buy insurance are usually paying, they have to meet a deductible and they have to pay a percentage usually of the cost and all of those things. So, you know, it can vary in terms of how it affects your bottom line. But this kind of dual pricing structure, that is how the system works right now.
Mm-hmm. Zane, it sounds like, though, the doctor was pretty upfront with you. No surprises there when it came to figuring out how much this was going to cost you?
Yeah, it was nice. I mean, he was a good doctor, but he was very upfront with it. And ultimately, because I was insured, I obviously didn't pay near $500. But to me, being a layman, I just was like, oh, they're just doing this to get more money. It felt like, anyway.
Mm-hmm. Zane, thanks for your call. I do appreciate you calling in. We're going to go to the Palm Coast here. We've got Steve. Steve, you're on the air. What are your thoughts on this issue?
Hi, Judith. Good morning. I'd just like to say that the problem with, I believe, Medicaid is that we get the government involved in this. And as we all know, government is force. And I think that the better way to serve people in this bracket would be charitable hospital institutions. I would gladly donate, and I know a lot of people would gladly donate a portion, you know, to these institutions to help the indigent people. Mm-hmm. We just don't like the force of government, and I believe that that's what you're seeing in the legislature. We definitely want to help people who are underserved, but I think that there's a much better and a much smarter way other than our state government.
Isn't, though, the argument against that, you know, if it's government money, then there's some kind of guarantee, maybe not in some cases, but the funds, you're going to have a better idea if you're a hospital, at least, of, you know, where those funds are coming from.
Well, I think that the guarantee that, you know, we are good Samaritans to each other would probably be would bode well for our society. I think that these charitable institutions would be overfunded in some cases, whereas, you know, people do not want to pay money to the government, but we'd gladly give out of the kindness of our heart to charitable institutions who serve these people.
Mm-hmm. Steve, thank you so much for calling in. I do appreciate that. Pat Rice from Daytona Beach News Journal, I wonder what your thoughts are on that. The caller there saying that essentially it should be left to the kindness of folks' hearts, you know, charitable institutions, hospitals that rely on those donations. Could that work?
You know, I think it might work if we spend the next two or three decades completely unraveling the healthcare system that we have. And I think it's a good libertarian notion. But I think if we were to try to do that right now, we would create two healthcare systems that would be disturbingly separate but equal. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that that would really work. I think it would be separate but unequal. Mm-hmm. And healthcare may not be a right. I think there's a great debate going on about that. But I think as a society, it is an obligation. And I would just have a lot of questions as to whether that obligation could be fulfilled simply by relying on the kindness of people's hearts.
Okay, we're going to go to another call here. We've got Jeff. Jeff, you're on the line from Winter Park. What are your thoughts on this issue?
Hi, thanks. Well, my concern, if we're going to provide price transparency, is if we're not also going to simultaneously provide information to patients about outcomes assessment for specific procedures for which they're comparing price, we're going to be doing a significant disservice. And if I can provide a brief example,
sure.
If you talk about total hip replacement, about two-thirds of surgeons who do total hip replacements do fewer than 15 a year. Those surgeons who do fewer than 15 total hip replacements per year have a complication rate that is 2 to 4 times the complication rate of total hip surgeons that are doing 50 or 70 or 100 total mm-hmm. hip replacements a year. And so without providing simultaneously information on outcomes for the procedures for which they're comparing prices, I think it's quite dangerous.
Mm-hmm. So it's a little more complex than just saying you've got to put those prices in a place that people can see and it's sort of easy to find those prices.
Yes, because it is absolutely not the same. I mean, I'm a veterinarian, I'm a veterinary surgeon, I'm a board certified surgeon, I only do orthopedics, and for a certain type of procedure, for an ACL tear,
mm-hmm.
some general practitioners will do that procedure. And they may charge 25-30% less than what we would do in total for in and out of the hospital. But if you look at the long-term outcomes on those patients, there's no comparison, but the clients don't know that. And then I know the same thing happens on the human side.
Mm-hmm.
I agree with the caller. Different. I mean, you know, I don't think that this call for price transparency should be mistaken for some notion that the cheapest price is best. A lot of us, when we go out and buy a car, we don't buy the cheapest car. Maybe some people do. But I know I look at safety ratings. I look at consumer reports. I look at all kinds of things. And I think that patients need to learn to be a lot more aggressive when it comes to shopping for healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
Price is not the only consideration. You know, I still think it's absurd that we're expected to go to a doctor's office or to a hospital and have no earthly idea what anything costs. But safety is important,
mm-hmm.
and there is some of that data out there, and that needs to be more available too.
It sounds too, from what some callers are saying, that it depends on your doctor. Some doctors are upfront, maybe others not so much.
For sure. And, you know, and that again comes down to, you know, you make sure you choose the right doctor for you, somebody you feel comfortable with, who's a straight shooter with you and who tells you you know, things that you need to know and responds to questions and all of those things. I do agree with the caller. I mm-hmm. believe quality is a big part of the equation.
Jeff,
with all due respect, honestly, most patients are not in a position to make the judgment of quality.
Right.
If you're basing it on whether you like the doctor, that's the biggest mistake you can make.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you need to know what the actual outcomes are. It's about numbers, actual success, and being able to judge what is a success.
Mm-hmm. So
you can't do that just because you like the guy.
Right. It's a complex thing. There's not just one thing you should be basing your your choice of doctor or procedure on, I guess. But Jeff, thank you so much for your call. I do appreciate you calling in. Going to get in one more call here from Kevin. Kevin, you're on the air from DeLand. What's on your mind?
Hi. Well, I just have two experiences of price gouging from Florida Hospital that I wanted to share that occurred to me this year. My wife just gave birth to our second child, and while she was pregnant, we were scheduled for a routine ultrasound.
Mm-hmm.
And our OB scheduled it at the hospital, not realizing that they would inflate the price so much. They charged us $1,200 for what, right down the street at a newer facility with better equipment, was only $115. And then when we actually had the child, it was a smooth, easy delivery, no complications, but it was in the evening, so we stayed the night in the recovery room. And the charge for the nurse in the room that night was $1,300, which in itself was fine. But later we received a second bill for another $1,300 addressed to my infant daughter. And when I called central billing about it, they were very aggressive and dismissive and basically said that's just how it's done.
Well, Kevin, let me ask you just back to the governor's point about transparency. Do you support what the governor's doing there, trying to get hospitals and healthcare providers to be more upfront about the prices they're charging?
You know, I can't believe I'm saying it, but I actually agree with Rick Scott on this one.
Mm-hmm.
Had we known if there was a place we go through, even our own OB was amazed and awestruck at how expensive it was. Had she known, she never would have sent us there.
Mm-hmm. Kevin, thank you so much for your call. I do appreciate it. You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. When we come back, we're going to talk briefly about Orange County Public Schools. They say the newly released Florida Standards Assessment Test data don't reveal how much useful information about schools. Well, if you have some thoughts on that, give us a call, 1-866-338-5252. Can those FSA tests be got right the next time around? 1-866-338-5252. Intersection returns in a minute.
Support for 90.7 News comes from Kennedy Space Center Visitor Complex, celebrating the 30th anniversary of the inaugural launch of Space Shuttle Atlantis. Visitors can view a live version of the video astronaut series Tell Me a Story and meet Atlantis astronauts like Jerry Ross, Mike McCulley, Bo Babko, Charlie Walker, Bob Springer, and more. Details at KennedySpaceCenter.com.
I'm Nicole Creston. Good morning. You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. We're taking your calls live. Join the conversation. You can also share your thoughts on our Facebook page or follow us on Twitter at WMFE Orlando.
Support for 90.7 News comes from Valencia College Continuing Education. Valencia's Collaborative Design Center was created to help businesses and organizations design solutions for cultural change, critical problems, and future development. ValenciaCollege.edu/continuingEd.
Welcome back to Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. With me in the studio, Beth Kassab, Orlando Sentinel, Frank Torres, Orlando Political Observer, and joining us by phone from Daytona Beach, Pat Rice. He's the editor of the Daytona Beach News Journal. Well, preliminary test scores came out Wednesday for the new Florida Standards Assessment. So these scores are for math grades 3 through 8, language arts for 3rd through 10th graders, algebra 1 and 2, and geometry for all grades. The Education Department says the data is the best for comparing how school districts fared against each other. Seminole County appears to have the highest scores in all subjects compared to other Central Florida districts, but educators aren't happy. The Florida Association of District School Superintendents said the grades are flawed, suspect, and incomplete. And Orange County Public Schools says these scores provide information of little value about the performance of our district. End quote. And the Assistant Director of Digital Learning and Assessment at Volusia County School says the new test doesn't take into account student growth from last year. Well, parents, teachers, what do these test results tell you about your school? Should they be counted? Individual test scores aren't out yet. Are you looking forward to seeing them? What's the next step for this test? 1-866-338-5252. Pat Rice, we've seen Seminole County call for an alternative to the FSA. Orange County hasn't quite gone that far, but they're still not too happy with that test. What's the general reaction or the response been to the test out in Volusia County?
Well, in Volusia County, Superintendent Tom Russell has stated that he believes the school grades should be withheld this school year and that the test be reviewed just to see how closely it aligns with state standards. I think the whole issue here, and I think you're going to hear that from pretty much any superintendent in the state, that the issue is reliability. And it's, I think, you know, there are always natural concerns about anything new that is placing a grade on yourself or the place you work or the children you teach. And I think that that's normal. And I think there are legitimate questions about the reliability of the Florida's the FSA.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the feeling here, and I think it's shared by teachers and the superintendent.
What about the opt-out movement? We have a burgeoning opt-out movement in Orange County, folks who say they send their kids to school on test day, but they basically open the test and don't take it. They're saying, you know, it's a way to kind of civil disobedience, if you will, against the these high-stake tests, including the FSA test. Is there any of that happening out in Flagler or Volusia counties?
You know, there may be, and I'm just not aware of it. But I don't think opt-out is going to be an effective way to come to some sort of terms or agreement about the FSA or any testing. I think it, you know, if the final measure is that the state and superintendents need to get together and come to some sort of agreement. And I think from our perspective, at least, the best agreement would be to withhold grades for this year and test the reliability of this test.
Mm-hmm. Beth Kassab, you've written about the dissatisfaction that's led to this new test in the first place. What impact does it have on parents when these results come out and schools say, you know, they don't have confidence in them?
Well, I think the lack of confidence is a real problem in the state of Florida right now. If you're just an average parent trying to keep up with the system, I'd say it's pretty difficult. The tests have switched. The standards have switched. And, you know, I think it's important real quick to just go back and remind everyone that the reason why the FSA, the Florida Standards Assessment, came about to replace the FCAT, which everybody hated, although it was a good test, and FCAT really shows, I think, the strength of accountability in Florida because we improved dramatically on national measures, and I don't think that can be I don't think that can be understated. But the reason why the FSA came about and we ditched the FCAT is because we upped the standards in Florida. The academic standards in Florida needed to be updated, needed to be parallel with others nationally. And so so the standards were changed. This was the whole Common Core debate that became kind of infiltrated with a lot of political rhetoric. And so the FSA came about because when Common Core was implemented in Florida, the governor's way of appeasing folks who were against Common Core was to get rid of the Common Core test, which was a national assessment that was already in development. So they said, we're not going to do PARC. We're going to make up our own test. And so lo and behold, we have the FSA.
Mm-hmm. Just for our listeners, PARC.
PARC was like a national consortium of states that had come up with that were in the process, at least, of coming up with a test to measure these new standards.
Mm-hmm.
And so when the state of Florida dropped out of PARC, they had to do their own thing. And that's how we got the FSA. And, you know, I agree that they got to suspend for a year the grades and some of these things. I mean, anytime you switch systems, like I said, it goes back to that lack of confidence that I can completely understand as a parent sitting out there, you know, thinking, you know, what's going on? Florida in 3 years has talked about three different tests.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's, you know, it's a lot of maneuvering and I think a time out on some of the punitive portions of the accountability would likely make sense.
Frank Torres, just the political angle here, Don Gates has said that he's interested, Senator Don Gates, in finding a new testing option. Is there much support for that idea amongst other lawmakers in Tallahassee?
I believe there is. You know, there's a lot of support for it in Seminole County. Of course, you might have heard of the Sunshine Solution calling for reform of the entire test. But I think it is political, strictly by pride standards. You know, the Florida Department of Education has been under fire for the previous years. I believe they've had three or four commissioners in the last, you know, 4 or 5 years. And they've spent a lot of money trying to develop this test. So I think as long as the taxpayers are still on the line or trying to justify these costs, you're going to continue to see the governor, continue to see Pam Stewart, the education commissioner, go to bat for this test regardless of the problems we have.
Well, you mentioned the education commissions. There have been a couple kind of cycle through for various reasons.
Yes, sir.
Pam Stewart's been there, you know, a couple of years, I think. So she seems to be sticking by this position, but could this, her stance on this test, could that harm her politically?
If I spent millions, as much money as we have on this test, millions and millions of dollars of on this testing, I'm going to stick by it too, because it just might be my job. And I think there is a certain amount of pride, a certain amount of accountability involved should she be left on the hook for this. Another education commissioner being replaced because of this testing. It's a tough situation for the governor to be in, as well as members of school boards throughout the state, and the students are paying the price.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've been listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. We've been speaking to Frank Torres. He's the editor of the Orlando Political Observer. Thanks, as always, for coming in, Frank.
Anytime.
Beth Kassab, columnist with the Orlando Sentinel. Thank you so much, Beth.
Thanks for having me.
And joined by Pat Rice on the phone from Daytona Beach. He's the editor of the Daytona Beach News Journal. Thank you so much, Pat.
Thank you.
Intersection is supported by Florida Hospital and by our listeners. The producer is Brendan Byrne. The executive producer is Catherine Welch. Production assistants from Nicole Creston, Abe Abarai, and Alex Gasparini. Next Tuesday morning at 9, Intersection dives into Central Florida's literary scene. Join us then. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.